Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. The USA drew Peru 1-1 in Hartford, Connecticut on Tuesday, but the big story from our perspective was the lineup from Dave Sarakin. We got a starting front three of Jonathan Amon, Josh Sargent, and Tim Weah. Reggie Cannon got his debut at right back. Aaron Long got his debut at center back alongside the grizzled veteran Cameron Carter-Vickers. Marky Delgado got his second start in a U.S. shirt alongside Will Trapp and Kellen Acosta in the midfield. Brad Guzan made his return from the post-Cuba wilderness. And Ben Sweat
was also there.
Yeah, got to play left back. We usually start from the back of the field and work our way to the front, but let's not do that today.
Yeah, let's go youngest to oldest today.
Yeah, good idea. But first, give us some tactical groundwork before we get into the individual assessments.
Sure. We want to go kind of over what the U.S. was trying to do, maybe, or what it looked like they were trying to do.
Yeah, please.
Well, I love the selections. I think a lot of people, certainly in my little soccer bubble, love the selections. I hated the formation, Bells. I really did not like the 4-1-4-1. And maybe I'm in the internet minority here, but I think it was bad. I think the formation was bad again. Like, first half of Mexico game, bad.
Not see a lot of the ball in the first half. I mean, we didn't see a lot of the ball the whole game, but the first half there were long stretches where we just didn't see the ball at all.
Yeah, and I think the one, two, maybe three like really exciting moments of the first half from the attacking side kind of paper over how bad I think the formation hurt us. And I think it's a real credit to Weah, Sargent, and Amon that we were able to get much positive out of it at all.
Yeah. Okay, so what was the sort of the overriding issue?
I think what hurt us the most was probably like the defensive shape of it. In the game against Colombia, I think in my mind it was pretty clear we were defending as a 4-4-2 where Julian Green and Bobby Wood had the same defensive job. They were on the same defensive line. Everything they did was sort of mirror symmetrically. That was not the case last night against Peru. Delgado sort of functioned as that Julian Green player for the most part, but only when Peru was initiating their attack. So when Peru was building out of the back, you'd see Josh Sargent and Marky Delgado sort of in a line. Mm-hmm. But as soon as Peru advanced the ball forward beyond them, Delgado would drop with it, sort of leaving Sargent alone up top.
Yeah, that seems to be what I saw too. Like Delgado was pressing forward initially, dropping back into essentially a holding mid spot.
This really sets up a completely different dynamic than Colombia. And I talked about Kenny Seff being sort of the falling domino in a bad way against Colombia. This sets up a sort of a tactical domino effect. It's not necessarily good or bad, but there's definitely this effect, this knock-on effect against Peru of Delgado dropping onto the midfield line. And that means one of Tim Weah or Jonathan Amon should be able to sort of linger higher up the field. They shouldn't have to come back to get into the midfield line because we already have, with Delgado back there, we already have four people in that line.
Wait, so who are the four people? Delgado, Trapp, Acosta.
And one of Amon or Weah. But you don't know which one. it changes for the situation. So if you're trying to compare, like, you know, I made a point of Kenny Seff's defense being pretty horrendous against Colombia. If you're trying to compare Amon or Weah and their positioning to Seff's, it's not an apples to apples comparison. You can't do it because what you need to do is if you look and you see Amon not getting back in defense, the first thing you need to look at is where's Marky Delgado? If he's back in the back line, Amon doesn't necessarily have to get back to defend. He needs to actually stay higher to help connect our attack once we win it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So it gets kind of complicated. The 4-4-2 is super simple, super basic. Everyone's role is pretty clear and doesn't change much throughout the play. You just keep your shape aligned. But in the 4-5-1, in the 4-1-4-1, that's not the case. Like, all right, so you need to read the play, and if Delgado's back and Weah's back, then maybe Amon stays a little higher. But That wasn't really what was happening. A lot of the times, Weah and Amon would both be dropped along with Delgado. So you have this line of five players defending behind the ball in the midfield stripe. Not the midfield stripe, but in that sort of midfield segment for us.
I can see that. And anything that takes a little bit of the blame away from Jonathan Amon, I'm in favor of, because, you know, I'm a big fan. Anyway, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
And, you know, we didn't have a ton of time. No, you're good. Because I kind of agree. I think it's difficult to judge the defensive job Amon was doing. I don't know if he was doing it right or not. But I also would say we had so little time to train on it that I don't really care if Amon was kind of screwing it up. It certainly wasn't for lack of trying, I don't think. So if he was positionally off, I'll be like, okay, well, it's a more complicated system and we had no time to really work on it and it's all new guys playing together. That's something that I'm kind of like, we'll be able to iron that out.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely think that was the case. Now, when you have those five midfielders all sort of sitting back in a line, that's going to cause Josh Sargent, if he wants to stay connected to our team, he has to drop as well. And I think that was the big issue for me, was watching plays unfold and watching all 11 of our players like 35, 40 yards from Brad Guzan's goal in defense when we're defending.
Yeah, I noticed that Sargent had at least two instances where he made a tackle or an interception in our box, which I see as, you know, I applaud that from a striker when it happens on occasion. But you're saying it was an indicator that we were just too compressed.
Yeah, super compressed. And not necessarily – I think one of the tackles in the box was after his terrible giveaway where we were in desperation mode and he really worked hard to get back to help right that wrong. But just in general, he would drift back just off the ball even to make sure that there wasn't a 40-yard gap between the midfield line and him, which is a natural tendency that a guy's going to have. And it might even be what he needs to do to stay involved in the play. The issue here, again, is it doesn't necessarily make us stronger defensively for all these guys to be dropping and putting in this sort of defensive shift, because we're inviting Peru onto us. You know, they don't have anyone to respect. They don't have to respect a counterattack because there's no one left to counter. So against Colombia, we at least had Green and Bobby Wood up top. Like, that's something you've got to worry about. Against Peru, there was no threat to run at him once we won the ball. So that really, I think that was the major component to our possession, was actually our defensive shape. Our lack of possession was, once we won the ball, there was nothing to do.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple times early in the game where Weah received the ball out in space, which I guess is kind of would have been the design of all this, right? You want one of those wingers to be open and not sagging back, and then, you know, Delgado or Acosta or Trapp can hit them in space. And it did happen a couple times, Delgado to Weah connections.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You need to be able to find them, and they need to then be able to play link up with Josh Sargent while everyone else bursts forward. Sort of the other little issue this causes is it's not always clear once we win the ball who's going to break forward, because you just have these five guys in a line. Against Colombia, I kind of liked our defensive shape against Colombia, even though I know the outcome was bad because we kept getting carved up. Right. On Seth and Robinson's side. But I liked that setup because once Bradley or Acosta or a midfielder intercepted the ball, like, it was clear who could run. We had the two guys. We already had Green and Wood, so they were going to be able to attack. Then it was clear that Weah and Seth should be bombing forward. And then usually whoever won it out of Acosta or Bradley could play it and charge forward, and the other one would just kind of stay home. In this game, it wasn't clear at all who was going to do those jobs. Weah and Green and Amon were so far tucked back defensively on a lot of occasions that even when we won it, it was essentially too over. I mean, it's too unappealing for Tim Weah to burst forward from the top of his own 18 on the weak side. Like, that's not a run that somebody looks at and is like, this will result in something good for me or the team. So that's sort of my long bit on our tactics and why we were so unable to possess or build much.
Yeah. I think so. The point of all that, at least the way I see it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is we're not trying to assess Dave Sarakin's coaching chops here. It's that doesn't matter. It's more just a framework for, you know, how did everybody perform? and given the constraints of the setup, and you know, what do those performances mean for the future of the player pool with that context in mind, right?
Yes. Yeah, spot on. So what that means is that's why I'm giving everyone a ton of latitude on, like, Marky Delgado. We managed to make Marky Delgado look like kind of a poor passer at times, and I just feel like that's sort of on the system. Marky Delgado's in other situations an excellent passer, and I think we put him in a tough spot.
Do we put Will Trapp in a tough spot too?
Well, I don't think we necessarily put Trapp in a tough spot because his job isn't really hindered. His job is still just to win the ball, shape the play, win the ball, and then connect to the next easy pass. He's not really the one to spring an attack, whereas Delgado, Acosta are sort of charged with springing an attack, and they're just not going to be able to do it. I don't think Will Trapp was particularly bad in this game. I don't think he was anything special, but he's a placeholder in the formation. I still think he's a placeholder on the roster.
Yeah.
What's your take on Trapp? Are you a little more critical or a little more generous?
I'm about where you are. Maybe a little bit more critical. We can get into this when we do the individual assessments, but I just thought his inability to turn into space. I mean, he's very safe when he's playing at this level. Had a couple knock-on effects. One, we couldn't build through the middle. Once again, that's been a theme for basically the whole year, with the possible exception of the Bolivia game and the possible exception of the Paraguay game. So he would receive the ball in the middle of the field, and he just didn't have the bravery or the technique, whatever it was, to turn into space that was available. So he would just tap it. He would tap it back to Ben Sweat. So that kept us from building forward. It also put Ben Sweat, a player that I'm not high on, in some tough spots, you know, where he's just receiving the ball right back from Trapp with a guy bearing down on him. And then he would have to play it back to Aaron Long or Brad Guzan.
So essentially, Will Trapp, rather than sort of dribbling into dead ends the way a lot of our guys have a tendency to do, Trapp sort of passes us into these cul-de-sacs where he's giving it to Sweat, who has no real next pass to make.
Yeah, it just seemed like a sort of a lack of problem-solving and game awareness from Trapp to keep tapping it back to Sweat, who was really struggling in that first half on the ball. I mean, he looked like he wasn't up to the level. So I don't know if that's so much a tactical problem as it is just a personnel problem at that position, and I'm ready to move on from Will Trapp, honestly.
I think we all are. And I think, again, I think Will Trapp is a fine sixth or seventh central midfielder, which is probably about where he stands right now. Probably fourth or fifth in that holding role, third or fourth or fifth in the holding role. So I'm okay with seeing a new face there in November. Yeah. I'm fine with the job he's been doing for Will Trapp. I think that's the job he can do. I think he's showing us what he has and what he doesn't have. So I think what he's shown is it's not Will Trapp's starting spot in the starting lineup.
Right. Well, we can talk more about him in a little bit. Let's start.
That's my tactical framework that I was kind of watching.
Okay. Well, one other big sort of point of controversy before we get into the positive stuff, because I think there's a lot of positive stuff here, but one other big point of discussion is the goal that Peru scored late in the second half. I think it was like the 85th minute or something. Was it on Yedlin? Was it on Delgado? I think that's the sort of debate, and I feel like it's sort of 50-50 in my little internet bubble, what people think about that. What do you think?
So I think Flores getting lost the way he did is not 50-50. Like, there might be half the people saying one thing and half the other, but it's 100% on somebody, and it's on whichever of those two guys was told to stay with Flores by the other guy. Like, this is a communication thing that should be taking place. In that moment, it's not necessarily clear who should or shouldn't have him, and I'll kind of touch on that more in a second, but it has to be decided by the two guys communicating. So if Yedlin sees Delgado with him and says, he's yours, then Delgado needs to stay with him and finish the play. If Delgado sees that there's another area he can slide into and pass him off to Yedlin safely, and he says, hey, you take him, then it's on Yedlin to finish the play. But that communication has to happen, and whoever communicates it to the other guy, it's the other guy's, and he has to finish the play.
Right, right. So we, so in a sense, that part of it is unknowable, even though, like, classic sort of defending 101 is that it's Yedlin's guy, right? I mean, Delgado should be shading towards the penalty marker and looking for that pullback.
Yeah, yeah. On paper, looking at sort of the breakdown on video from above it, it's definitely the outside, the fullback's job. It wasn't like our shape wasn't bad. We weren't numbers down, so it wasn't a desperation defending situation. Delgado had time to essentially stack up on top of Yedlin the way you would in our shape there, and for Yedlin to be responsible for the deepest, highest, or the widest, highest attacker on that weak side. So on paper, I would say, if I'm drawing it up for hypothetical situations for the defense, Yedlin picks that guy up, Delgado stacks on top to pick up anything in front of him.
Okay. Well, I guess my way of looking at it is Delgado was clearly marking that guy. He had him in his sights, Flores, that was. And then when the ball came in, Delgado was kind of shading towards the penalty marker, but not really. He was just kind of jogging back towards the goal. So even though it's on paper, Yedlin's guy, I wish Delgado had maybe taken more responsibility there in one way or another. Because clearly it wasn't communicated to Yedlin that he should slide over.
Or it was, and Yedlin just didn't think that the perfect ball was going to get played across. It was an amazing ball in, just out of Aaron Long's reach in a spot where CCV can't really make a play on it without putting it into his own net. Even Yedlin would have had a difficult time dealing with it. He would have essentially, his best play would have been to seal the guy off and let it run past both of them. But yes, I can definitely see where you could assign the blame to Yedlin or to Delgado, and you could well be correct that it should have been Delgado staying with him.
Okay. Well, we'll let that sort of simmer.
Should we go through the actual players? Start with the kids?
Yeah, let's take a little break and then we'll go through the players, starting with the youngest.
I love this, Bells. I love bragging about our kids.
Me too. We'll be back in a second. All right, we're back. We're going to go youngest to oldest in the starting lineup, and then we'll say some things about the subs at the end here. But the youngest player on the field was, in my opinion, the best player on the field. And you can disagree with me if you want, Greg. Josh Sargent created the two brightest moments of the first half with his passing, a back heel at midfield to Amon, and the little slip pass to Acosta. Lovely stuff. And then he got on the end of a ball from Amon and set up a Weah chance early in the second half. Then he got the goal on a set piece that he fired low and hard on frame. It ricocheted in, but it was low and hard on frame, which is kind of the key thing. Aside from an early giveaway that sprang a Peru counterattack, I thought he played basically a perfect game for a striker. His hold-up play and passing are the things that really set him apart, in my opinion.
Yeah, amazing hold-up play and amazing, he just has an amazing map of the field. The little Cruyff ball to Amon that set up sort of the most exciting movement, the team move. That's that nuance that we're just, searching so hard for in everyone else who's been playing in attacking roles. We scour the video for, one moment where they do something unexpected and throw the defense off. And Sargent pulls it off, and I mean, he did it in his 10 minutes against Colombia. He did it once too, and he does it right there. And then his little outside of the football to Acosta is in the same class.
Yeah,
we just go so long without seeing that, and he does it twice in 40 minutes in this game. That's such a breath of fresh air, and it's the reason that I was excited about this whole friendly window is because we wanted to see if we had something like that in these kids. And Josh Sargent gave it to us.
Yeah, that outside of the boot pass too. I mean, that's such an unthreatening situation. It's a throw in from wide. He takes it off his chest, seals the guy on his back. He's moving across the top towards the top of the box. And then, I mean, he basically slipped Acosta in on goal, and it only a very, very bad touch from Kellen Acosta prevented that from being, you know, I don't know, what would it be, like a 0.5 expected goals situation?
Yeah, I don't want to pretend like I'm in Kellen Acosta's head, but I'm going to go ahead and guarantee that the reason Acosta's touch was so bad is because no one else that he's ever played with on the U.S. makes that pass. I don't think he was expecting that ball to just be put directly into his path running full speed at goal. Yeah. I think it took him by surprise. He's making that run for that pass, but I don't think he in any way expected the pass to come in that way.
Right. He believed, but he didn't believe.
So next time we'll actually get the end product out of that ball. But yes, tell me what you think of his goal. Because I know it's a lot of obviously it deflects on its way in. Did you think it was like a sort of a fluke goal?
No, I mean, I've seen so many goals like that from Sargent where, I mean, he hit it hard, you know, it's not like he scuffed it.
And that's exactly what I'd say. He chopped it intentionally. So it's the technique that he used. He was running at Kellen Acosta, who was delivering the service. And he didn't try to use his laces. He didn't put the inside of his foot through the ball like a placement shot. Like he cut it. Like he's making a disguised pass. And for me, the intent is to bypass all the traffic that's at the near post, including the goalkeeper. And he did it. I mean, he didn't bypass it super cleanly, but he got it all to the wrong side of that traffic so that the one defender who did have a chance at it couldn't get enough on it and just deflects it into the side net.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, is that coaching or is that just instinct or I don't know. Whatever it is, it's great. But he kind of Ozil'd it.
It's playing a ton. Yes, that's a great – Ozil would definitely have that technique.
Like chopped it into the ground.
So I'm calling it a sophisticated finish.
Okay.
I mean, there's a bit of luck to it. Like that defender might have been able to make a better play on it. But it wasn't just like rolling harmlessly towards goal and then it gets deflected and now the goalkeeper's wrong-footed. Like the keeper was unsighted and was going to have a tough time reaching it, whether it was deflected or not.
Right.
Unless I'm just misremembering it and need to watch it a bunch of times in super slow-mo.
I mean, it went through a few bodies, so, you know, it could have easily been blocked and we wouldn't be talking this way. But point is, he scored a goal. He had basically one real chance to score, and he did score. And I don't know, man. He looked really good last night. He's the big thing to be excited about, I think, from that game. Just excellent.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think I would much rather see him called up to the senior team in November than the U20 team in November.
Which is
weird.
You're listening,
Greg Berhalter.
Which is weird because he, you know, he's still not getting minutes at Werder Bremen, which is the second best team in the Bundesliga last I checked. He'll get there. If he plays like he did last night for Werder Bremen, I think he'll be just fine.
Well, he probably is, for at least for Bremen too.
Yeah, well, he is, yeah. Just a way, way different level. I mean, it just didn't seem like he was fazed by the physicality or the speed of play.
No, he was dictating the speed of play for the defenders. I mean, he was essentially making them try to reach his speed of thought rather than the other way around.
Yeah. Should we stop praising him and move on to anything else on Sargent?
No, let's get to the next 18-year-old.
Timmy Weah started on the right wing, moved over to the left wing in about the 30th minute. I thought it was a quiet game for him. I mean, he set up a couple chances from the right wing early, often, you know, but in both cases, it was a ball he received from Marky Delgado, one for Acosta that Acosta kind of hit with his left foot in a pretty non-threatening way.
And then Acosta just stabbed at it.
Right. And then he got the ball to Sargent's feet in the box. And Sargent, I think he tried to lay it off for Marky Delgado. I think that's what he was trying to do with one of those little Cruyff touches, but it didn't come off. And maybe Sargent should have hit that with his laces. I don't know.
But that's how I read that situation too. And I was indifferent. I mean, I'm just like, at this point, Sargent, try whatever you want and we'll take what, with the ones that do come off.
Yeah.
That way out ball into Acosta though, I think can be sort of underappreciated. And I just mean the weight and the line of it. Like he put it directly where Acosta didn't have to do anything but run onto it and strike it. So that's a big deal. I mean, that's a really important part of success in the attacking third is not making your finisher waste any time, wasting any movement.
Yeah, and I wish Acosta would have put his left foot on inside it and then hit it with his right foot. I don't know why he did it with his left foot. I guess just maybe it was another example of a good pass surprising Acosta because he was like just a half step behind where he could have been. I thought Weah looked pretty frustrated later in the game, and he got a little sloppy as the game progressed. So not his, in my opinion, not his best outing, but I still rate him pretty highly.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think it goes back to my issues with the formation too. You know, you think about how invisible he was against Mexico in the first half. I think this was sort of like that. So again, I'm giving him credit for being able to contribute in ways when I think the formation really didn't set him up well to succeed.
And
go ahead.
Well, and I was just going to say, and so that contributed to his frustrations probably.
I think so. I think you could tell because he was sort of so invisible, the few times that he was actually available and able to get used and that when we missed him, I think there were just a couple of passes that were errant. That just adds to that frustration. Like finally I have a chance to make a play and then the ball isn't put where I need it to be put. And so he's showing that frustration a little bit. I imagine he's used to better service in Paris.
Well, what do you think this shows us about Sargent and Weah big picture?
My big takeaway is we need to put to rest this whole, like, you got to earn the call up nonsense. To me at this point, it rings very much like you got to play. There's a right way to play baseball. Like, we're seeing the opposite. Like we're seeing that Josh Sargent and Tim Weah, who have what, 45 minutes of combined first team, football under their belts this season. Weah played the
something
first half
like
of
that. Yeah.
PSG's opening league game and hasn't been on the roster since. Josh Sargent hasn't made a roster all season for Bremen. There are two brightest attackers, Weah in the Columbia game for sure, Sargent and Weah in this game. You got to pick your best players. Like, I don't care. There's no transitive property about Novakovic plays in this league and Josh Sargent's the fourth division Bundesliga player. Like, so you should call and play Novakovic. Like, I'd be shocked if Novakovic would have been as effective as Josh Sargent. I wouldn't expect it. I think Sargent is clearly the number in the top three at this point of our attacking depth chart. And I don't care if he never sees the first team for Bremen this year. He's the guy until his play for the U.S. shows he's not.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. And Dave Sarakin at least seems to agree right now. You know, he's given way a... He started Weah both games this camp, gave Sargent a start. I think that's where we are right now. And forget about Novakovic. There's other people like, you know, Paul Arriola on the wing. And I don't know, who are some of our other wingers who have gotten a chance? Julian Green, Kenny Saif. It sure seems like Weah is a better wing option than any of those three. And Sargent sure looks better than Bobby Wood too, you got to say, don't you?
For me, yes. I thought Bobby Wood was actually good, and we'll talk about him later. But I think it kind of just speaks to this unique point where in our ability to develop elite players, and I'm using elite in sort of the U.S. historical context, but also in the if you're good enough to play in the Bundesliga at 18, you're probably an elite player like at that for an 18-year-old. So if we're starting to produce these players domestically, and this is the first wave we've been able to do it, then when they go over and sign with their big teams, so we have Tim Weah at PSG and we have Josh Sargent playing for Werder Bremen, not playing for him, but they're in that lineup. If you wait as a national team, if you wait to call them up until they've broken through into the first team, then you're going to be sitting on superior players. You're going to be calling up inferior players because of, again, that sort of dogmatic, well, they haven't done it yet philosophy. And I just think that's so the wrong approach. I think you call in your best, and it's everyone else's job to play better soccer than they are, not necessarily to be playing first team in the Danish division or the Swedish division and sort of hanging their hat on making it into the first team. You have to be better at soccer. I feel like that should be an uncontroversial stance, but the better soccer player gets called up and plays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does also seem like public opinion is moving in that direction too. Like people are starting to not really care that Josh Sargent hasn't played for Werder Bremen's first team. When you put on a performance like last night, it doesn't matter anymore.
And again, Tim Weah almost being like a ho-hum starter at this point at 18, just like, yeah, Tim Weah's a starter, of course.
Yeah.
Like, that's just the case now.
Yeah, it's going to be so fun to see how they look with our first choice midfield, whatever that is, and Christian Pulisic on the other wing.
All right, let's talk about our next teenager then.
Okay, a slightly older, 19-year-old Jonathan Amon. He's come under a lot of criticism in the last 24 hours for his defensive technique, and he did have some giveaways. But unsurprisingly, I'm going to have a different take. I thought he had a couple good moments in the first 15, played Ben Sweat in over the top. Sweat just stopped with the ball. And most people probably won't remember that play, but I did.
Sweat was nervous. I don't want it to be a pun, but he had like this sweaty feel about him for the first 15 minutes.
You don't want it to be a pun, but it still
is. I don't
is.
Want it to be. It was like desperation. It was like this desperation cologne that he was wearing, you know, being a 27-year-old. Like, this is his chance. I'll talk about it more when we get to him. But, yeah, go on. Other Amon positives.
Yeah, I don't get any pleasure out of Sweat's struggles, just for the record. But
I don't either. I was, like, really wanting him to make it. Again, what a cool story for the guy. He's earned it.
Right. Well. Okay. Amon also.
He's done his part.
Well, so back to Amon. He combined with Sargent on that sort of brilliant move up the left wing. That was Acosta had it. He played the ball to Sargent in some pretty heavy traffic, and Sargent just punctured the balloon with that back heel into Amon's path. Amon took a touch past a Peruvian defender and was just free and clear running down the left channel. He tried to play an outside of the boot ball across for Weah, who was crashing in on the right wing. Weah couldn't quite get to it, but I don't think it was that bad of a ball. And I think Weah, if they had played together a little bit more, Weah might have sort of expected that kind of pass from Amon and gotten to it. I also thought, I'll stop and let you get a word in edgewise here in a second, but I also thought Amon's presence to some extent neutralized Advíncula, the highly rated right back for Peru. We've shared a pass map back and forth. Advíncula in those first 30 minutes didn't really get forward much at all. And Amon's defensive technique is, he's 19. He plays in a league that doesn't emphasize that, apparently. So I'm not going to say he has great defensive technique, but I just didn't think he was as bad as everybody's saying on that front. He didn't get beat a ton, and Peru didn't have that much joy up that flank. And he had those two moments. And then in the early part of the second half, Amon played a very crucial role in the lead up to the goal. He played Sargent in behind with a pretty nice ball. Sargent squared to Weah. Weah's shot was wide. But a little bit later, he combined with Reggie Cannon up the right wing, and Cannon kind of lost it. Amon won it back and then won a free kick, which resulted in the goal. So all that to say, I thought it was a very promising debut for Jonathan Amon. I'm done.
I'm with you. Super excited about Amon's first, because what I was really deathly afraid of was that Amon was going to come out and be completely lost. And it was just going to mean that being able to attack in the Danish league, you can be an unstoppable attacker in the Danish league, and it just won't translate at all. Like, maybe it doesn't require a good understanding of the game or whatever else. So I was so scared that Amon was going to be on the field and be completely out of sorts, completely lost. And I don't think he was that at all. I think defensively he did have some sort of some decision struggles about how to get into a stance and defend for an extended stretch, and an extended stretch being like 15, 20 seconds. Right. But he was, I do feel like he was actually working at it. Like, he was trying to be in the right spot and trying to work back to help. But attacking wise, which is really all I care about right now, I was pleased enough with his decisions. I was pleased enough with his willingness and ability to combine. He wasn't just like, all right, I'm going to get it and run full speed at the defender and use my shiftiness to get past. He looked like he had other solutions in mind. Now, that said, there were times where he did just sort of run in and make his decision too late. Like, he didn't have his timing right on when to release the ball.
Yeah. I mean, the game was a little fast for him. I think there's no doubt about that, particularly in the first half.
Yep. But what I like is you can almost see the wheels turning, so you can see what he's attempting to do. And he did it often enough. I mean, he wasn't flawless, but I only need him to do it a couple of times to say he's capable of it. And now we just let him play more and see if he can do it more and more frequently.
What do you think about that? This idea that I have posited, that just his presence, you know, as imperfect as his performance was, I think everybody watching the game could see, like, this is a dangerous player. Like, if he gets the ball at his feet, he could do something to break open this game. How much do you think that, just simply that presence on the field, sort of tilts that side of the field in our favor?
I can see that being a big deal, especially when if you pair him with like an Anthony Robinson, who, efficiencies aside, you have to like respect what Robinson threatens bursting beyond you. And so if you have to deal with Robinson and Jonathan Amon, that definitely seems like it's got the potential to be a real dangerous flank.
Yeah. And I would say, and one last bit of praise for Amon is there was a moment right before he came off where Delgado played a diagonal ball to the corner and Amon ran onto it and just kind of stopped and picked his head up. And I think it was the kind of situation where you would think Amon would try to take his guy to the end line and cross it. And the left back, who's, I think it was Loyola for Peru, was giving him like all kinds of space, like 4 yards of respect. And Amon just picked his head up and played a clean pass right into the box to Josh Sargent's feet. Sargent, you know, did a couple Cruyff turns and then his pass, he tried to play a pass in the back post that was blocked. But I just thought that was a nice moment of composure and sort of productivity from Amon that might have gone under the radar a little bit. And then
so that's a really good spot, because again, it just tells you he's not one dimensional. He's not a one dimensional player. He's not just a threat 1v1 in space.
Yeah. Yeah. I really do think that's true. And I hope he's called up again in November. And final point is, when Julian Green came on in the 54th minute for Amon was the first sub. The American attack fell apart. I mean, it just, that was basically the nail in the coffin of us being threatening.
You're making so many enemies on the Julian Green side of things. I hadn't talked about him yet, so this was your doing.
Yeah, I mean, but it's true. Like, I'm not saying it's because Amon is some kind of like instant world class player, but we didn't attack after that. Really, we didn't threaten after that.
Okay, I haven't done my full rewatch of the game yet, so. I'll be interested to see sort of what all happened, because just like we couldn't give Julian, I didn't want to give Julian Green the credit when we improved a lot against Mexico after halftime, after he entered. I don't want to blame him here, because the other thing that happened when Julian Green came on for Amon is the whole formation changed, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'll want to go look at it and see whether or not it was like we completely just lost the attacking impetus because we didn't have Amon available. So who slid out right then? Was it like Delgado? Delgado went to the right?
Yeah, that's what happened. And then Green was kind of – it was more like a 4-4-2 with Green in the middle. Well, I just want to be precise about this. I don't blame Green for the way the game shifted when he came on necessarily. He's just not the same kind of player Amon was. He's not as threatening. I want to be very precise that I don't necessarily blame Green for the way the game shifted when he came on, because like you said, there was a formation change, but also he's just not the same kind of player that Amon is. He's not as threatening. Delgado tried to play him in behind a couple times and Green was never going to get to those balls.
Well, so we can definitely say whether it was the addition of Julian Green, certainly removing Amon really changed our ability to threaten.
I think there's no doubt about it. And so
that's a good thing for Jonathan Amon.
Very successful debut in my mind. Let's, you want anything else on him, or should we move on to the next youngsters?
Well, just cause I can't ever end on a really positive note. Again, I'm super cautious. So my glowing review of Jonathan Amon doesn't mean I'm penciling Jonathan Amon into the starting lineup or even necessarily like the first backup role. I'm penciling Jonathan Amon into another camp. Let's get him into another camp and let's get him 90 more minutes of game time in November or January if he's available. But let's just get him in. He's back in the he's in the fold for more looks.
Yeah, that's where I am too. I'm definitely not putting him in the starting 11. I think Weah probably has an edge on Amon, just a little bit more polished, a little bit more calibrated to this level of play. I think that's fair to say. The next youngest guy was Reggie Cannon, who got his national team debut at right back. FC Dallas, 20-year-old, might be 21. I think he's 20. I gotta admit,
young. He's young.
Yeah, he's young. I gotta admit, I didn't see a lot good or bad from him, but the reviews I'm reading are that he was really good, and I would go so far as pretty good. Nothing spectacular. And then, of course, he comes off and Prue immediately scores a goal on the back post. So
Reggie Cannon in this game for me wasn't in a good position to show anything offensively. Like, I don't think that because of the formation again, because of that 4-1-4-1 with the right wing sort of so far out already on the sideline, it makes it really difficult for Cannon to get up and contribute. He still did a couple of times and he looked really competent in those combinations when he got forward, but it wasn't there. There was never like a big wide open space for him to run into, or very rarely. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he's not going to do anything that looks great because our shape is he's going to essentially just be sitting back behind the winger, both in defense and in attack. So I don't think the door was really open for him to shine, but I still think he was really solid. No big mistakes. It's still a pretty good outcome for a 20-year-old right back making his national team debut.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that I take away from this with Yedlin coming on and being at least partially culpable for that goal is Cannon is – I'm not saying Cannon surpassed Yedlin. That would be a ridiculous thing to say, I think. But I do think he's getting closer to Yedlin. Like he drew slightly closer to Yedlin in the depth chart.
So we can say Yedlin isn't untouchable, basically. You know, we used to kind of just talk about everyone was fighting Moore and Cannon. We're just fighting to be Yedlin's backup. But maybe that's not the case. You know, not necessarily over the next 6 months, but over the next 9 months.
Yeah, I think you know, if Cannon keeps improving and, you know, keeps getting chances and looks good, he's going to keep getting closer to Yedlin, because I think we know what we get with Yedlin. He's 25. He's got his limitations. He's got his strengths. Cannon's only 20. You know, hopefully he keeps improving. I know you believe in a linear line of improvement, that it goes at a 45-degree angle for every player. So I'm applying that here.
Over time, yeah, we can exactly predict everybody's improvement.
So anything else on Cannon?
I don't really, depending on FC Dallas' situation, I don't expect him in necessarily in November, but I think he's nailed on for January and probably at the top of the right back list for January.
Yeah. The Dallas has a Dallas is in the Western Conference, and I don't really think there's that much gap between any of the teams in the Western Conference, so I wouldn't be surprised if they get bounced early in the playoffs, but I can't remember if that would even help him get a call up. Anyway, doesn't matter that much.
No, we just want to keep seeing him. I mean, and I'd be shocked if he's left off of any games he's available for the next few windows.
Yeah, he's certainly surpassed Shaq Moore, hasn't he?
I think so, and I think we were kind of based. We already kind of thought so based just on what we see in his MLS play. But I think he looks to me a little tidier. Like his footwork when he has the ball. It looks like he's able to open up a passing windows that I don't think Shaq Moore is great at opening up. Shaq Moore has to play the windows that exist already. And I think Cannon can essentially, again, disguise what he's doing enough to move a defender even just a step or two so that he can hit the window he wants.
And I
Not
think,
necessarily, and I'm not saying he's going to put someone in on goal with the pass he wants. I'm saying he wants to get it to Kellen Acosta in central midfield so he can move the defender with some deception and get it to that, make that pass.
yeah, I think that's true. And Fernando Clavijo, the former technical director at FC Dallas, tweeted last night that Cannon was a little bit nervous to start the game and got a lot better in the late first half and second half. I think that's probably fair, and it's just a good point about several of these young guys and older guys. I think Cannon was a little bit nervous. Amon looked pretty nervous.
And
Sweat
sweat, I
was
sweat for
obviously
sure
nervous.
did. You could kind of see that edge, that nervousness kind of came off as like a little edge in the first maybe 10 minutes when Cannon got taken down in the box or went down in the box. He was fired up about it. Like he gave the referee an initial bit of business and then the ball went out for a throw and the business continued.
It's true. It was a little much. He's no stranger to remonstrations, I guess you could say.
But yeah, that's like the energy of like they want this. Like I don't it's a friendly and the result doesn't mean anything, but for Reggie Cannon, like
It's a big
he's been
deal.
waiting for this. This is a shot. So yeah, he was after it.
Yeah, totally. The last youngster before we take a break is also 20 years old, or maybe 21. This is the 20 to 21 duo here. Cameron Carter-Vickers. I thought he was pretty good. I mean, solid. His decision making when he intervenes, and his combined with his physicality means he's just very decisive. Like cutting out a cross or tracking down somebody in the corner. I didn't see anything I didn't like from CCV, and I haven't always been a big cheerleader for him, but he just keeps looking like a good depth option at center back.
Yeah, and that's important to have for when a guy's 20 because if he's already a depth option at 20, in 3 years he could grow quite a bit. So to already have him established as a reliable piece right now, that's massive. So that again, that's really promising. Just like we just are taking for granted the fact that we have all these like reliable, promising 19, 20-year-olds.
I know it is really crazy. I mean, there's a good chance in my mind that by the time the World Cup rolls around, there will be only three or four players over 25 on that team. I think some people would call me crazy to say that, but I think we're gonna be a lot younger, a lot quicker.
No complaints here.
No complaints there. Okay, so let's take another break and come back and talk about the next oldest guys. Who are mostly in the midfield.
I am that old Lord
All right, we're back. The midfield. Man.
Mid-20s. Mid-20s in the midfield, right?
Yep. It works out nicely because Acosta, Delgado, and Trapp are the next oldest players after CCV. I got to say, big picture, I can't wait for Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie to be back.
They're the clear winners of the midfield performances from these two games.
I would say so, yeah. Let's start with
Acosta.
No
one was bad. Like, I'm not saying that anyone was bad. So, yeah, so let's talk about Acosta.
Why don't you start on Acosta?
I wish that he hadn't been played in a 4-1-4-1. That's my default answer for all of these midfielders. But he was essentially in between. Like, Delgado was the guy who started higher when we were defending, so Acosta like naturally sat in a little bit more. And I think he's effective when he sits back like that. I think that's where he should be playing in this personnel grouping. I think Acosta's best spot is to sit back a little bit. Because he's a bit of a ball hawk. Like, he reads the game pretty well, and he can jump passes and passing lanes. And he can, even if he can't jump the pass, he can arrive at the attacker at the same time the ball does and actually come out with it. He can win that battle.
Sometimes, yeah. He's the best of the three in this game at that, for sure.
So that's a positive. I think the negative is still what it's always been, in that you can't rely on him to receive a ball cleanly in traffic. Like, you just don't know if he's going to. So you're rolling the dice. He's very – it's unlike like a Delgado who, if a ball comes into him, I'm expecting him to – if he can't receive it and play, I'm actually expecting Delgado to hit like a one-time pass immediately that I didn't even see until he hit it. Mm-hmm. I don't think I get that from Acosta.
No. Yeah, he sure did put in a shift, and he looks like he's working hard out there when you watch on TV. And he is, obviously. But like you said, his untidiness reared its head a few times. That first touch on that gorgeous pass from Sargent was probably exhibit A. But he also tried to push the game some. Which Trapp really didn't, and I guess you would say that wasn't really Trapp's role. My thought with Acosta is that he's not enough of a ball winner or a dominant presence in the middle. Like I said, he's better than Delgado or Trapp at winning the ball, more of a ball hawk than those two. But he's not enough of one to compensate for his untidiness, and he also doesn't build a ton of rhythm in the midfield, you know, the way we like to talk about Delgado doing.
Right. And that's I think that's a combination. Mostly, I think that's sort of that first touch that you can't rely on. And if you can't rely on the guy's touch, it's hard to like play fluidly around him.
Yeah. Yeah. I said, so Trapp's a little more technical than Acosta. Go ahead.
Here's a question for Acosta and his sort of ball winning. Cause I kind of get what you're saying. He's not enough of one. If he's your best ball winner, then I can see how that would be a real issue. But if you're playing, suppose you're playing with Adams, McKennie, and Acosta in a midfield, does that sort of change the picture? Like, if all of a sudden Acosta's your third best ball winner, it seems like he's an amazing third best ball winner to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's if the point of the game is to have a pretty good third best ball winner, then sign me up for Acosta in that trio. But I think if you have Adams and McKennie there winning the ball at a much higher level than Acosta, then you don't need that from that third midfielder. You need something else.
Okay. All right. I kind of get excited thinking about how like a relentless we could play with those three, and how all three of them are capable enough with the ball at their feet. I know, again, that's sort of Acosta's weakness, but if he's really good at ball winning, and he's occasionally okay with the ball at his feet, mm-hmm. when we're trying to attack after, because the idea is we would win the ball a lot in midfield and just be able to run it an unset defense. Acosta doesn't have to do it perfectly every time. He just needs to do it a couple of times where he controls it well enough and makes the next decision.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not opposed to that, really. I think we the relentlessness we could play with there is appealing, but I think what we need with Adams and McKinney is more of a connector. And again, no surprise to anybody, I think that's going to be the next guy we talk about. But Acosta's in the mix. He should be there in November. He will have no obligations with Colorado, arguably the worst team in Major League Soccer. So I assume he'll be there in November. I hope he is. And who knows how Berhalter will set things up. But I imagine he may well be in the starting lineup too.
I think we need to see it at some point. I think we need to see Acosta with McKinney and Adams in a central midfield. I'm not saying that's for sure the right one, but I think we've got to see what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, we sort of saw it against Portugal. It was Danny Williams, Acosta, and McKinney, and then Adams out on the wing against Portugal. And we did a lot of ball winning in that game. So that augurs for your point.
There we go. All right. So if we're not going to go straight three ball winners, then one of the other options would be Marky Delgado.
Yeah, who had a mixed game last night. I'll be the first to admit it. I still thought he was the best.
Blame the formation.
It was all because of the formation. Well, he was the best of the midfielders, I thought. I thought he was better than Acosta, even though he was in the frame on the goal and has some culpability for it and didn't have his sharpest night. Like you said earlier, there were points in the game where he didn't look like a very good passer.
Yeah, blows my mind. I don't care at all about the Yedlin-Delgado mix-up for Delgado. He's not a wide defender. That's not his position. If he does make his way into the team, it's not going to be as the right winger. Mm-hmm. So his ability to track weak side runners for crosses isn't anything I'm terribly concerned about.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm going to just go on a little praise rant here. I really like what he does. From the 7th to the 15th minutes when Sargent sprang Amon into space, Delgado keyed the attack all three times we got into the attacking third. He turned in really tight space. I'm going to get a gif out of this and spray the ball to Wea.
Was that the 35-yard, 40-yard ball that Wea wasn't even in the screen when Delgado received it?
Yes. And it was – and Delgado – go ahead.
Go on, Bells.
Well, I just thought that was a
– We're both so excited about that exact moment.
Well, it was so good because it was kind of a loose ball or Sargent was coming back to it, and he played the ball to Delgado through a guy's legs. Delgado has three guys around him, I would say all within 5 yards. But he was checking his shoulder earlier in the clip. He knew Wea was out there all on his own. He turned and he just pinged it right onto his feet, 35 yards. Wea's isolated 1v1 with Loyola, the Peruvian left back, and Wea puts the ball on Acosta's feet pretty close to the penalty marker, which, like we talked about earlier, Acosta hit it with his left foot out of bounds. But that's like instant offense from basically entirely from the mind of Marky Delgado.
And I loved that, Bells. I loved that moment because as the ball's coming to him, I'm like, ooh, that's putting Delgado in a real tough spot. So most of the time what U.S. fans are used to is at best like Delgado just solves it with a pass back to Gazan or a center back. You know what I mean? Like that's all we're hoping for is like, please, Delgado, don't turn this over right here. And instead, under like immense pressure in a really dangerous area of the field, for him to come up with that ball and hit it perfectly, that's like Bell said, again, we're looking for those glimpses of like technical nuance and tactical awareness. That's a big one on the GIF thread for you, Bells.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to do a full Delgado GIF thread because I don't want to deal with the mentions on Twitter, but I'm going to have to do that one because that was really good. But that wasn't the only one. There was another time where he received the ball turned and played Wea into space again. Another time where he got the ball kind of in the right channel in our defensive third and dribbled a guy and was patient. He could have played it to Sweat. He was patient. He let the space sort of open up, and then he zipped it out to Amon. And that was the time when Amon took a couple touches inside and played a ball over the top to an overlapping Ben Sweat. Several of the times where we look like an actual soccer team, it was because of Delgado. It was because he plays Usually he plays quickly. When he doesn't play quickly, there's a good reason for it. And I mean, that's my take on it. He did have a few sloppy moments, a few sort of miscommunications, and there was his role in the goal. So it's not a perfect night for him, but still the best midfielder on the field for the U.S. for me.
Not only do I agree with you that he was a big part of our best moments, but I think he also did really well at helping the formation that I think, again, was poorly set up. I think he did a great job of like solving some of those issues in real tough spots. Like you just end up with, we were so compact that once we'd win it, we were trying to connect four or five passes in this horrible shape, like horrible spacing. And Delgado is a guy who finds little solutions to that really well. I wouldn't put Trapp or Acosta at fault here, but because of the way we were set up, they'd like hit a ball. They'd all be standing within 6 yards of each other, 7 yards. And they'd like ping a ball into him. Like they're like, that's their only option to not turn it over is to like hit it right at Delgado. And Delgado would just has these like velvet feet where he just sort of like almost settles it to the next guy, which is, I know that's basically the point you make about Delgado all the time, but I think there were some instances where we really saw that in action where we had no business sort of getting out of some jams. Anyone else I think would have just stopped dead at their feet and then gotten blown up. But Delgado just finds some surface of his foot to use to angle it out of the traffic, and set somebody up with time just so we could expand and not be in this terrible possession shape.
Mm-hmm. One last thing I'll say about him is he was braver. I think he was braver than Acosta and Trapp in those tough situations. You know, he was the one more often than not who took on the responsibility to receive the ball and do something inventive with it, move it forward in some way. Trapp definitely wasn't brave at all. And Acosta, like we said, doesn't have the tidiness to be brave, really.
Right. If Acosta tries that, he takes his first touch a yard and a half away from him and it just gets taken off of his foot. Delgado is a really subtle, clever player. And for me, that's a great audition for Delgado to be part of a three-man midfield setup and do exactly the job that you want him to do with McKennie and Adams.
Yeah, I think McKennie and Adams would really benefit from that too. I want Delgado to be the one recovering the ball after, you know, Adams clatters some guy in the middle, because he and McKennie will be able to find quick productive solutions. I think
yeah.
Delgado's the highest IQ midfielder we have, soccer IQ.
Yeah, the fantasy is just like Adams wrecks somebody, and then because Adams is superhuman, even as he's finishing the wrecking job, he's also like bolting full speed upfield, and Delgado is just puts it right in his path in space, cuts out one defender, and it's Adams running full speed at an exposed back line.
Yeah, I mean that is not a crazy fantasy. That is near term reality in my opinion if Delgado is on the field.
All right, but we don't know. Like, that's Delgado's one that Berhalter or even Sarakin, like, Delgado's certainly not a guaranteed call-up in November. He won't have playoffs, but MLS playoffs, but I still don't, like, I wouldn't be putting a ton of money down on Delgado being in the 20th, in the call-up list for the European trip.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I guess... you know, well-intentioned people can watch the same game and come to different conclusions. And there are plenty of people who came away from that game concluding that Delgado wasn't very good at all. Let's move on to Will Trapp.
Yeah, what did everyone conclude about Will Trapp?
I think Will Trapp suffers from a public relations kind of disadvantage in a way. Plays for the guy who's going to be hired as the coach. He's not a very exciting player. And... you know, a USMNT Twitter account called him the man of the match after the game, which was pretty ridiculous. I don't know. He just seems
I didn't even see that.
He's like the favored son, and nobody wants anything to do with the favored son in the fan base. All that aside,
he's got that, like, he has that, like, classic, like, intangibles tag attached to him, which is so often like he's not very good at other things.
Yeah. I mean, and as you showed a few weeks ago, the intangibles thing is just kind of smoke and mirrors. I don't know what that is. I guess there's the leadership, locker room leadership that we will never really know about. I just don't think he defensively is enough, offers enough, and I don't think he's brave enough on the ball. So I don't feel like we need to talk about him too much more, but he's probably a bubble guy for me in the 23 if everyone's healthy.
Yeah, sort of a bubble guy. We're really waiting to see what happens with, like, a Russell Knaus. But I kind of agree. Like, Trapp is I think he takes more heat than he really deserves because he should just be considered like a placeholder. Like, but I think the heat he takes is because everyone is essentially worried that he's being anointed by U.S. soccer and the eventual, you know, his club coach who will take the job as being this key cog in our future. And that sort of makes us just react to him a little more negatively than he probably deserves on his own merits.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it. Like, maybe there's a clause in Berhalter's contract with USMNT that he has to, that, you know, Trapp had to be named man of the match in this game, so, you know, something ridiculous like that. I'm not saying I really believe that's just a joke. That's a joke.
But Trapp being man of the match is, like, suspicious enough that you have to wonder if it's an overture to Greg Berhalter.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems silly. He was not the man of the match. I mean, I could see Aaron Long. I could see Josh Sargent. I could see Kellen Acosta, maybe. But not Will Trapp. Come on, guys. Let's move on to the next one, this guy. Aaron Long.
Let's talk about Aaron Long then, yeah.
25-year-old center back for the New York Red Bulls is having a really good season. I thought he was great. Maybe a little over-dependent on Trapp to play out for him, just like CCV, but maybe that was the scheme. And I thought it was very solid defensively. Didn't put a foot wrong, as they say.
Yeah, Long and probably CCV both benefited in a way that Miazga and Brooks didn't, in that Cannon and Sweat weren't getting, like, just roasted. So they almost never had to make those, like, last-ditch decisions about, do I go cover for him, do I stay and try to defend against an undefended cross. I'm not saying that means they were bad. I just mean I don't think we got to see them at the extremes. What was thrown at them, they handled really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really excited about that too, because I think Long can be a really solid depth option. And I saw that Matt Doyle, the MLS analyst, he argued that Long could be pushing Miazga and Brooks for a starting spot. He thought he was that good last night. I don't know if I'm ready to say that, but I'm not. I don't think it's a ridiculous thing to say.
No, so. the depth chart in general is at a really fickle place right now, and that's why, like, Cannon can so easily jump Shaq Moore, but then Shaq Moore could jump him again after 90 minutes. Anthony Robinson is the guy, but now suddenly Anthony Robinson maybe isn't the guy. And Miazga and Brooks have done really well, but that doesn't mean that they should just get to inertia their way to 2022.
Mm-hmm. Right. Ben Sweat.
Okay, so before we get into his overall play, again, really happy that Ben Sweat is doing, like, for Ben Sweat. What a cool experience. And I'm not that's super condescending. I mean, good on him. Like, he's battled through a lot in his career.
Sure.
And just kept working. So this is a cool reward for what Ben Sweat has done. And he looked like a guy who didn't want this to slip through his fingers. In, like, the second or third minute, we get a throw in. And Ben Sweat puts it, like, right in between Will Trapp and Kellen Acosta. So I don't know whose fault it is, whether it's Sweat's, Acosta's, or Trapp's. But it basically is a throw in directly to Peru, yeah, who just get to run at us with Sweat out of position. Sweat, like, stares daggers at Kellen Acosta after he Sweat recovers actually pretty well, then gives away kind of a dumb corner that he shouldn't have given away.
Yep.
But he is staring daggers at Kellen Acosta like, you do not screw this up for me, Acosta. Like, I need this. And that's where I got that like desperation sweat where like he can't lose this. Please just let me like you are not they are not going to put that throw in on me. I think even pointed at Acosta like giving it to him. So
I noticed that too. We want our players to play that way for the national team or feel that way at least.
Right. You can just tell that tension is like eating him alive for the first 10 minutes. And that's what I feel like it looked like while he was playing.
Yeah.
He settled down, right?
Yeah. He settled down in the second half. The first half was pretty bad, particularly his work on the ball. Just looked like he didn't want it at all. Like, please do not pass me the ball.
Which is strange because New York City play all the time, right? I will concede I haven't watched a ton of New York City, so I haven't seen a ton of him playing MLS. But that's how they play, right?
It's how they played under Vieira, but I think they've been a lot more lump it long under Dom Torrent.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
But I know the level's pretty different as we're finding. I mean, as we're sort of finding out about a lot of these MLS bubble guys, they're just not quite there. Now, that said, Sweat did play better in the second half. And if I'm going to praise Amon, or at least obliquely praise Amon, for the fact that Peru didn't generate too much down the right wing, I'm going to have to praise Sweat for that too. I thought his defending was a little bit more solid than Robinson's. It's probably fair to say.
Yes. Yeah. Sweat wasn't sort of abused the way Robinson was.
Yeah, he wasn't facing James Rodriguez either. Neither was Jonathan Amon.
And he didn't have Kenny Seth trying to do the work in front of him. He actually, again, that makes a big difference that we had Delgado, Acosta, Trapp, and one of Weah and Amon, or both of them, working pretty hard in front of the back line.
Yeah.
That's actually quite the shield.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It did make a big difference. I don't know. I don't know what the next step is for Sweat. If he gets called up again, I guess I wouldn't protest. But if he never gets called up again, I'll be totally fine with it. We just don't have any. We don't have great left back options, which is just a line we can copy and paste in every single podcast we record.
Yes, which is again why Robinson, despite that annihilation, is probably still the first call in November.
Yeah. Brad Guzan, let's go to the goalkeeping expert.
Nothing you can do on the goal. It's hard to know if Guzan sort of should get some of the credit for the fact that we were much better organized defensively than we were against Colombia. I don't know if that's because of Guzan or that could be partly CCV or Aaron Long, or you don't know who that voice is. And again, against Colombia, it's impossible to organize if one of your one of the players in your formation just quietly takes a knee every 7 or 8 seconds. So I'm not sure if Guzan has a role in the organization or not.
Okay.
He didn't have much to do, did he? I mean, there wasn't a lot for him to do, shot stopping wise or collecting crosses.
He palmed sort of a dangerous cross/shot. Over the crossbar at one point, and I don't think he could have done anything about that goal, right? I mean, that was out of his reach. It's kind of, I mean, in a weird way, kind of comforting to see him back there for me, which maybe I'll get roasted for saying that, but just seemed like a commanding presence. I know that's all just witch doctory to say that, but...
but I think Guzan and Stefan are probably like one red and one blue, right? Like, I don't know who would, I can't say for it with any real confidence that Stefan is a better goalkeeper than Guzan for the Gold Cup this summer.
Yeah. I think that's probably fair. I think Stefan gets the edge because for the future, but I don't feel very strongly about it. Let's talk very quickly about the subs.
Okay.
Quick. Julian Green. Give me two sentences on him.
Didn't even know he was in the game. I saw our shape change, and then I forgot that he was there.
Yep. Michael Bradley.
Kind of the same thing. He actually did come into the game, right? Yes, he did. He didn't have anything to do. I mean, we essentially, I feel like the last 7 or 8 minutes, we stopped playing any kind of soccer whatsoever.
Yeah. The subs did just tear apart any sort of attacking chemistry we had, like we talked about earlier. And with each sub, it seemed to get more disjointed. Bobby Wood, I think you have a little bit more than two sentences on him.
I thought Bobby Wood was good. I thought Bobby Wood like essentially showed that he was a class above the other Americans on the field when he came in. I don't think he necessarily showed that he was like way better than Josh Sargent. Like, we didn't upgrade at forward, but I would say Bobby Wood was still like better than the players surrounding him. I thought he really like showed that yes, he does play at a different level than most of these guys.
I didn't so much see that, but I'm not gonna argue with you.
All right.
DeAndre Yedlin. We've discussed him some already.
Yeah, he didn't really do it. I mean, Cannon didn't really do much because he wasn't afforded much to do, and I don't think Yedlin did much either. And again, we kind of stopped really playing by the time he came on, so he fell asleep once, or we don't know necessarily what happened, but he was involved in the miscommunication / execution on Peru's really like second or third chance of the game. Only is that about what Peru had? 2-3 chances: the crossbar, the dangerous cross in, and then the goal.
Yeah, I mean, Peru outshot us 14-5, but a lot of those were speculative from distance. I guess I don't know what the expected goals is, but it didn't seem like it was a lopsided contest in that way. I think they probably had a little bit of an edge, but not a huge edge.
Yeah, there were no times where like Guzan was frantically like moving across his goal, praying that the ball would go wide.
Right. And then Anthony Robinson, the last sub, yeah. I sort of not applicable. I'm glad he got to see the field, but he didn't really, there was no really information to discuss.
No, that seemed like Sarakin realizing that we had stopped playing, and so it was very much take another 30 or 40 seconds off the clock and let's not end my tenure on a loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't know that his tenure will end. We just hope so. Not because we hate Dave Sarakin, just because we want to get the train rolling.
Yeah, I think we're ready for that for the train at this point. We're very ready.
Okay, let's wrap it up. We got to go. We've gone on too long. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Greg. We'll see you.